like Mike would show up, so I give a little bit more of a motivation, but I'll go through it fast. If you don't understand something, please slow me down, okay? Then I'll explain my effective field theory setup, and then I'll, most of the talks, so probably this is the place in the world where you have had most talks ever on this effective field theory treatment by Walter, by Rafael Porto, by Chad Galli recently, by Misha. So most of those talks, I guess, were mainly talking about the conservative dynamics of those binary systems, and I'll be mainly talking about the radiative dynamics of the radiation sector and on new results for getting there. I'll conclude. Okay, so Einstein's general relativity predicts gravitational waves, and so far they've only been indirectly detected, but in the next few years, we're looking forward to direct detection in many experiments, such as LIGO, Virgo, GEO, TAMA, and which are all Earth-based interferometer experiments. So they're like, you know, like very big L's, and when a gravitational wave goes through, the arms of the L get a bit longer and shorter, they wobble, and that's how we're hoping to. So this change in the length of the arms we're hoping to detect in the lasers from the interferometer, and that's how we want to detect the gravitational waves. And there's also, in the future, LISA, and that probably won't happen for another 15 years or something like this. Okay, so one thing I'd like to, so I don't know much about these detectors, but one thing I'd like to point out is that they have a noise curve. So on my x-axis in this plot here is a frequency, and here is some kind of measure of the sensitivity. And roughly speaking, this black curve is the theory curve, and then you can see the data is really getting to the theory curve now. The experiment is reaching its design sensitivity. This curve is a cartoon that's like a U shape, okay? So that means if you have a given sensitivity, it'll enter the detector band where you can actually detect something that's not higher than the noise, and it'll exit it at some frequency. So this frequency range is, you know, theorists very cartoon, between 10 and 10 to the 4 hertz.
So this is, the black curve is their expected best sensitivity.
Yes.
And then there are different runs. Running for how long? I mean, this
has been old data, so there's been run S6 data published as well, I think.
But how long do they stay in this region where they're getting the sensitivity? I'm not sure what these different bands mean.
Oh, the different curves are different runs of like what have improved.
Okay, so the point is
the detector is set up, and I don't know.
And they basically get to a steady state with this sensitivity.
Yes, that's right.
That last one is really as long ago as 06. That purple run?
Yes.
Bottom?
So the last run was actually, I think it's S6, but it was enhanced LIGO, it was called. It was an update on LIGO.
So they're already at the design actually, sensitivity limit.
Well, but they're currently, so they're kind of continuously updating LIGO, and that's actually what I have in a few slides. So this black design curve was for initial LIGO. And then there was enhanced LIGO that was running until, I think, the end of last year, till the end of 2010. Now they're currently analyzing the data from that enhanced LIGO run.
It's amazing. You've got, 2-3 orders of magnitude improvement in sensitivity?
Yeah.
From the oldest to the new.
Yeah. I'm not sure what really went into that in terms of hardware and, you know, analysis techniques and things like this. Or just, you know, understanding a detector. I'm not sure. Okay, so where would those gravitation waves come from that we're hoping to see? And there's a whole bunch of sources. For example, there are pulsars, some kind of bursts from supernovae, or maybe from head-on collisions of black holes, some cosmological stochastic background you could expect. But I won't talk about any of these. I'll be only talking about gravitation waves from coalescence of compact binaries. So those compact objects in the binary system would be two black holes or two neutron stars or a black hole and a neutron star. They're coalescing, that means they're getting, you know, they're going around each other, getting closer and closer. The orbit is decaying due to emission of gravitational waves. So I don't have much to say about the other sources in my talk. So the state of the field is no gravitational wave has been detected directly yet by our detectors. However, this update to LIGO called Advanced LIGO that will be running in four years from now, that's promising to have a 10 times higher sensitivity. Which means, so this curve will go down by another order of magnitude, and that means that it can look 10 times further in space, that means the volume increases by a factor of 1,000. So that's your event rate that you expect. So if we believe the dirty astrophysics that gives you estimates for event rates of binary in spirals per volume per time, then you know, even if you're taking the most pessimistic values, we should get tens of events per year in LIGO. In advanced LIGO, yes, that's right. So people are very excited right now in the field. So how about these coalescence events? Let me tell you a bit more detail about it. The initial phase is the so-called in-spiral phase. There are two black holes or two neutron stars, etc. Compact objects are still well separated. That means their separation is much larger than their radius, their Schwarzschild radius or their neutron star radius. This phase, for example, for the famous Hals-Taylor binary pulsar, this phase there will take another 50 million years or something like this, that order, before they actually then come to the final merger and ring down phase. And so this is a very regular, you know, it's kind of a sinusoidal curve, and you know, the frequency depends on, so at the beginning they're very far away from each other, the frequency is low, they get closer and closer to each other, it goes faster, the frequency goes up, the amplitude goes up as well, there's more energy emitted in gravitational waves. And then at some point the horizons of the black holes, or the, you know, they'll actually merge, the so-called merger phase. And then finally there's a ring down phase where then you have just one black hole. If you can talk about black holes now. And basically it's non-spherical, it's perturbed. It'll basically ring down, radiate away those additional moments beyond being just a Schwarzschild black hole. Okay, so I have to update this part. The merger phase, now the waveform has been solved due to big advances in numerical relativity recently. And this in-spiral phase that I'll be talking about in my talk, that can be treated perturbatively. And that can be done in an expansion, in a non-relativistic expansion, in typical free velocities, which are related to the other expansion parameter in GR, GM over R, by the Virial theorem. And what I want to point out is that you can see up to 10,000 cycles of this in the LIGO band. So I told you there's some lower frequency where it could enter and some higher frequency where it could get out of the detector band. So during this time, you can see up to 10,000 cycles. And how do you find the gravitational wave signal in your detector data? So it will be way more messy than this illustration up here. But roughly, you have some noisy data. And you want to find some underlying theory curve. So here you can see by eye that there's a sinusoidal modulation. And fortunately, my theory prediction curve down here is not so well visible. I hope you guys can see it a little bit. Basically, the way you claim a detection is you do a method called match filtering, where you basically take the convolution integral between your noisy data and the theory template. And if this convolution integral gives you a big contribution, then you claim you're seeing a gravitational wave. And if you think that you're calculating a convolution between data and a theory curve, for this convolution integral to attribute to something, the most important thing is that the phase matches here. Okay, so because once your theory curve gets out of phase from the data, this integral will just zero out. Okay, so we need to know the phase to a very high precision. And since I told you that you can observe 10,000 orbits, 10,000 of those cycles in your detector, the phase has to match for those 10,000 cycles. So we need to know the phase to precision better than 1 part in 1,000, maybe 1 part in 10,000. And how do we calculate this phase? So the way we calculate the phase, or it's usually calculated from the energy balance argument. Basically, you're equating the power emitted in gravitational waves to the time derivative of your conservative energy. And this allows you to calculate the phase. So from our point of view, in order to get this calculation of the phase done, we need to calculate the energy E of omega and T of omega. So those are really observables expressed in terms of observables. So it's tricky in GR. So those are really observables. And they, in order to achieve sufficient precision for advanced LIGO to do extraction of source parameters such as, you know, the masses or the spins of the black holes, you need to know those two quantities to the order v to the 6 beyond the Newtonian order in this post-Newtonian non-relativistic expansion in the typical free velocity squared. So order v to the 6 beyond Newtonian is usually called the third post-Newtonian order, or 3pn. And so I emphasize that the phase is the most important, but the amplitude is also of interest. And higher precision there is also important. For example, Lisa's angular resolution can be improved by knowing more about the amplitude, including higher order corrections in the amplitude as well, and also for comparison to numerical results, which is a big business at the moment. The higher order corrections to the amplitude are important. Okay, so for our current project, which is this calculation of those spin effects, let me tell you what has been calculated already. So if you neglect spin, the phase is known to 3.5 pn, so v order v to the 7th beyond the leading effect, and the amplitude is known to a third post-Newtonian order. However, once you include spin, that doesn't match. So the spin, the phase evolution with spin is only known to 2.5 pn, and 2 pn is the level that the amplitude is known at. And it turns out for neutron stars, that's certainly fine, but for black holes, spins can be very close to maximal. And so we think it's important that we actually, in the end, match the precision of the waveforms also when you include all the spin effects.
Spin of the two bodies are...
Yes. So I'm assuming they're roughly of comparable mass. I'm not using a mass ratio.
Comparable mass and comparable spin as well.
No, it didn't have to be of comparable spin. That's not necessary. One can have zero spin, one can have bigger spin. So this is a long-term project, you know, actually getting from 2.5 to 3.5, from 2 to 3 here. That's not just a paper you can write in 2 months or something. It's the long-term calculations, and also not... Well, yeah, also then boiling down things that are really useful for LIGO and LISA, etc. So this is done together with Rafael, Ira, and Michele Valisneri at JPL. And what kind of physics can we learn from these binary in spirals? So it's a, well, we could learn something about up to the third post-Newtonian order in the perturbative regime. So in the solar system, we're only sensitive to the first post-Newtonian order. So it's a stringent test of GR, but also importantly, we can test GR in the strong coupling regime where you compare to numerical curves. We can measure from our comparing theory templates for different configurations of the source parameters, such as the masses and spins. We can actually learn what are the masses and spins of those black holes that I'm seeing signals from, or neutron stars. We learn how many times do those events happen. I told you there was a big astrophysical uncertainty there. We can hope to learn something about the structure of neutron stars and black holes, and I have something briefly to say about that. And finally, we can use binary in spirals as so-called standard SIRMs that have been proposed a couple of years ago to measure the cosmological properties such as dark energy or structure formation in the way.
Something that confuses me here, I think I'll ask this question to other people as well. I'll ask you, maybe the answers change over time. You're going to such high precision here, mm-hmm. as far as I understand. And I would think that these black holes, they're astrophysical systems, so I think it would be like a dirty system, like tidal forces would rip other stuff that was there apart, and it would introduce extra effective scales in the problem of other sort of distributions of matter and such.
Yeah, that'll be my effective field theory setup, that explain the scales and how those are super clean systems, actually. So you're wondering what are the systematic errors in these cosmological measurements? Is that your motivation for asking?
Yeah, and also your calculation. I mean, mm-hmm. in the sense of when are there other scales involved with some other matter distributions and such in these systems, or is this
what kind of other matter distributions?
Well, just as I said, it's just tidal effects ripping all sorts of stuff around it apart.
Okay.
It could be like just a lot of crap around these black holes.
Oh, you mean in between the black holes?
Yeah.
So I would guess
in a big glob of gas or something.
Okay.
For
I would guess that by the time they really do the inspiral, all this crap is cleaned out. I'm guessing here, though.
Are there like numerical GR simulations which can give you a handle on whether to believe this or not?
Well,
I guess you can do anything.
My understanding is a lot of things Luis is working on is trying to actually put in crud around black holes and see magneto hydrodynamics and see how.
But my guess is that the mass of the black holes is so much heavier and so much more compact than anything that's around it. I'm guessing here. So I would guess it's probably negligible.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that Lewis does, there is not much back reaction on the gravitational waves. It's just the point is that you have something like a magnetic signal, you want to see what it is, because yeah. that's what you can see. You cannot see Gaussian sure. triangles as easily. But there are scales introduced into your problem which would affect your effective field theory calculation, or if they are introduced, the effects are just so small.
I think they would be just incredibly small, yeah.
For black holes, probably, but neutron stars, even for neutron stars, you think? You already have a question mark there, like neutron star question.
Oh, so no, I will talk about the finite size effects of the two compact objects themselves. But Mike was asking about having some junk flying around
yeah.
the binary system. I don't know much about that. So I think I've read abstracts or, you know, titles of papers and browse through the abstract while checking the archive. People that study these type of things, and I had the impression that it doesn't matter for the gravitational wave signal. Maybe one can find some electromagnetic.
You should be able to.
Sorry?
You should be able to mock up some simple sort of effective matter distribution. So
yeah.
Introduce
sure.
scales like that you think would be characteristic of that sort of effect, and just show that it's just pretty cool.
Sure, you could put it on a disk or into some halo or some. I guess you could do that. But I'm guessing. That, you know, this violent emission of gravitational waves really comes from having these objects being so compact. Right? It's like when I do this, I should be emitting gravitational waves, but it's just super negligible. So I'm guessing that only really, really compact objects contribute to the gravitational wave signal. That's my
thing. One fun fact was that doing what you were doing, it takes 1,000 times the life of the universe to emit one graviton.
I love that someone had that calculated.
That was
also for what to emit a graviton?
He was taking that hockey stick. So it takes 1,000 times the life of the universe to emit one graviton.
From him shaking that stick?
Yes.
You calculated that.
That was last. Somebody else did that. I'm quoting him, but apparently that's enough.
Oh, wait, so just...
Okay. Well, I guess we should move on with the rest of the talk. Okay, that's interesting. It's an estimate. Okay, so now let me describe this effective field theory setup, and I get back to the question of finite size effects here. So what we'll do is we look at the system, we identify the scales in the system, and we exploit that the scales are different in my system to set up an effective field theory description, an effective description of the system. So let me point out the scales here. So this is my terrible cartoon of the binary system. Here there are two compact objects of extension RS. Schwarzschild radius of a neutron star is just a few times, you know, 5 to 8 or something like this, times the Schwarzschild radius. So you can count it as Schwarzschild radius. The separation I call little r is the orbital separation, which is much bigger, as you can see, by assumption during the in-spiral phase, than the size of my compact objects. And the frequency of the gravitational, the wavelength of the gravitational waves emitted is even bigger than this orbital frequency. And it turns out that all these scales, RS, R, and lambda, so finite size scale, orbital scale, and gravitational wavelength, they're all correlated, and this correlation is given by the typical free velocity in the problem. So this is just, this just follows from the Virial theorem, and this is just, you know, motion in a circular motion gives you this. And so now how do we build effective field theories out of this? So my full theory, and of course in quotation marks since we don't know quantum gravity, but my full theory would be some description of extended objects coupled to general relativity. For neutron stars, let's say two fluid balls, if you prefer that type of description, coupled to GR. But if you're interested at scales larger than their finite size, RS, then you don't need to consider this full theory. It's better to match to an effective theory. And the way you model this effective theory for those two extended objects is you match to a theory of two point particles that are coupled to GR. And these point particles will also encode that they are actually not really point particles, but they really are fluid balls. I'll get back to that in a second. So this is what you do at the finite size scale. You integrate out those compact objects and match them to just point particles with higher dimensional operators encoding finite size effects. So there's a way to do that. I'll show you in a minute. And then at the orbital scale, if you're interested at, so this theory is valid between the finite size and the orbital scale. If you're interested in observables characteristic of length scales even larger than the orbital scale, such as the wavelength lambda, which I wrote as R over V here, then this is also not the most effective description. But you know, you can think of this as having two point particles really close to each other, and looking at them from really far away, they would just look like one point particle. So you match to just a single object coupled to gravitational waves and, at the orbital scale. So you integrate out the binary itself and match to just this one object, where endow this object with multiple moments, and these multiple moments encode all this dynamics, this internal dynamics. That's what's really going on there. And yeah, then if you want to calculate gravitational wave observables, you have to do that at the scale lambda. And those little blue arrows here denote renormalization group flow, and I actually have something to say about that. It's very interesting. So what are the features of this effective field theory treatment? First of all, we can systematically account for the physics at each scales. We can disentangle the scales, breaking down the problem into smaller, easier to calculate problems. We have a definite power counting. That is, there's no guesswork involved. It's systematic. We know exactly from the setup which diagrams we have to calculate to a given order. Once divergences show up, and they do when you treat things as point particles, they're well understood. We can use the standard renormalization and regularization program from, you know, and love from quantum field theory. And last but not least, we can also use renormalization group methods to resum logarithms, for example. And I'll show you how we do that later. And this is an alternative to more traditional post-Newtonian methods to expand Einstein's equations. And it's usually going to names Blanchet, Buonanno, Damour, Scheffer, Will, and others. OK, so then let me show you some equations. Here's the action that I want to describe the system with. In this regime here. So I'm integrating out a finite size scale and matching to a theory of two-point particles, okay, coupled to general relativity. So my action away from the two-point particle sources is just, well, Einstein-Hilbert action, but since I want to calculate Feynman diagrams and I need to calculate Green functions, get a propagator, I need to add a gauge-fixing piece to my action, a gauge-fixing action, so I use harmonic gauge. And this is the action describing the two sources, the two-point particle sources, the leading order.
Sorry, what is gamma mu?
This is gamma mu alpha beta g alpha beta. That's really the trace of a Christoffel symbol.
So this is how you impose the harmonic gauge. So how does that impose the harmonic gauge, actually?
If you linearize that, it's just something like, and so if you writing down g mu is eta mu plus h mu, so I expand around Minkowski spacetime, and then gamma mu will just be something like h plus d alpha h alpha, something like this. I'm probably getting the factor of a half in the wrong place, and there's a minus sign missing somewhere, but yes. So this was many times considered as a linearized harmonic gauge.
But shouldn't there be like a Lagrange multiplier or something like that when you want to import the gauge?
What do you mean? So it's totally not analogous to what you do in ENM, for example.
It is like analogous.
Yes.
Okay.
So you're thinking of going to like an arc psi gauge or something like this, putting some arbitrary coefficient into
it.
Yeah,
that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, we don't do that here. So harmonic gauge seems to have nice properties when you calculate. And yes. So the propagator is easy in harmonic gauge. That's one example.
Yeah.
But also, yeah, well, let's leave it with that. So we have then for the two-point particles, well, this description of two-point particles as an action here. And then the dots will encode the finite size effects, telling you that, well, these aren't really point particles, they're really neutron stars, or really black holes. And how do I get these dots? Where do they come from? Well, you take the spirit of effective field theories. What you do is you just write down all possible operators. Of course, there are infinitely many possible operators. And the operators have to respect the symmetries of your system, which are reparameterization invariants. So you can parameterize your world line, which parameterizes the point particles each in a different way, so that's RPI, or reparameterization invariance, and general covariance of GR. Of course, you shouldn't break that one either. So the way you do it is you do everything in terms of proper tandem d tau. When you have, for example, velocities, you take them to be derivatives with respect to proper tandem as well. So then you're fine with that with RPI. And general covariance, well, you can just stick in geometric quantities. So you put in, for example, Ricci scalar, Ricci tensor, and then those are actually Riemann tensor squares written in a funky notation I just explained in a second. And what is important to note here is that the leading guys, so, well, basically, this is a derivative expansion, okay? So here there are no derivatives acting on your gravitational field. Riemann has two derivatives. Sorry, Ricci tensors both have two derivatives. Then here you have Riemann squared. That would be four derivatives, etc. It's an expansion. So the derivatives give you powers suppression by the orbital scale r, and that has to be compensated by those coefficients in front of it, the so-called Wilson coefficients, and they have to scale with the finite size of your object. So it's a power expansion in the finite size over the orbital separation. Okay, so that's why I can truncate this. There's an infinite amount of operators, of course. I can write down to encode the finite size effects, but I can truncate this. And interestingly is that those guys, in terms of Ricci's, they can actually be removed. Those are not physical operators. They're so-called redundant operators, and that's because the vacuum Einstein equations are r minus equal to zero. That means you can do a field redefinition. You can just parameterize your metric slightly differently and set these coefficients to zero. If you want, you can keep the coefficients, calculate with them. In the end, out of any observable, they're guaranteed to drop out. So the really physical guys are, so these are the electric and the magnetic components of the Riemann tensors, and those operators are squared. So those give you the leading tidal effects here. And you can just now power count, as I told you, so you power count, you know, how many derivatives are there, etc. And you can show that they first entered order v to the 10 beyond the Newtonian potential in conservative dynamics, and the same in radiation order at v to the 10 or order 5 pm. So that's pretty much hopeless for black holes, at least. For neutron stars, there is a caveat, because what I power counted as the Schwarzschild radius, being the radius of the compact object, is really the neutron star radius now for neutron stars. So it turns out that these coefficients here scale with the fifth power of the neutron star radius. So I made a mistake of r neutron star over Schwarzschild radius to the fifth power. So that could be 5 to the fifth or 7 to the fifth. So that could be measurable. That's still a bit under investigation. I have the impression that at LIGO, advanced LIGO, it will be hard to measure these finite size effects in the InSPER.
But that depends on how big V is. If V is big, then...
Well, V sweeps your frequency band of the detector. So, you know, when you enter the detector at low frequencies, V will be low, and will get higher and higher before the merger phase. So it's kind of, you know, it's your coupling constant, but it's not constant in a sense. Okay, it's your expansion parameter, but it varies while you're detecting the signal.
So at late time, you might see it. I mean, even if it's V to the 10.
Yes, that's right.
What is V typically at late times?
0.3, I think, to remember, roughly for neutron stars. So it's not super tiny. It's pretty damn relativistic, right, though.
0.3 before the merger?
Yeah, I think so. Before it gets out of the frequency band of LIGO.
So basically, you're saying LIGO can see it all the way down to essentially down to LIGO. It's 0.3 is.
It depends on the masses of the two objects. So neutron stars, we know the masses are between, you know, of the order of a solar mass, a bit heavier than that. But for black holes, we can have 5 solar mass black holes, 50 times. You know, there it depends. Okay. So I'm not sure, again, on which of those two objects merges inside of the LIGO band and which ones doesn't. Some don't. Yeah, it depends on the masses. Okay, so now the other ingredient we need in our setup is to incorporate spin in this effective field theory. Do you have any questions on... Yeah, well, you dare to ask questions here. So that's good.
One question.
Yeah.
Go back. I was thinking this when you were explaining it. Tell me what's wrong with this thinking. If say this is happening in a dust cloud or something, and you're integrating out finite size effects, why can't you just approximate all that mass distribution by another point particle and do a three-body problem? And then,
well, if this is really compact, then you could do it. But it's something like a dust cloud. Well, the free body problem, you can do exactly the same thing
as
we do here.
Yeah. I was just wondering what, why, but I guess that's just not worth it.
A dust cloud is...
It's going to be small in the effect. Or even not even a dust cloud, some somewhat uniform distribution of matter around these systems if there's lots of junk. So can one just do that sort of thing? I think one could.
I'm sure you could, yeah. I haven't thought about that. But
it's not... There are lots of degrees of freedom, right? Because it's not going to remain uniform.
But you can model it as a fluid.
Full expansion on this background in some sense, right? That's the idea here of the black holes. So why not just do it on the background, too? That was my question.
Well, you would describe it like a...
structure, but it's a structure would be on small scales, right? So you could do... I would think you could do that.
But why do you want to multiple expand it?
I just want to just make it so that it's not... You don't have to worry about all this... individual, you know, small-scale structure.
So I guess the density then there would be small in some measure, but I'm not sure how to set that
up. In that case, C1 and C2 are not redundant anymore.
Well, that was my linked question to that, because, yeah.
Okay.
What he said. Because, and then how would that, I mean, is that obvious? Because the lower order in the urban expansion, even if this is small, you know, mass distribution or something, is there a lower order in the urban expansion? Maybe that there's still some...
So the way I like to think about these guys is if you have, you know, if you're looking at Einstein-Maxwell equations, I guess, gravity coupled to E and M, the energy momentum tensor is also not zero. You have the one from E and M. So then, but then you can replace, you can still use the equations of motion and you can replace it in terms of something that's only coupling to the electromagnetic field. There, I'm not sure how that would look for... if you have some other kind of fluid around.
Okay.
But it's an interesting question, and I haven't thought about it.
It just seems like some question that can be answered, it's easily answerable in your formula.
Yeah, you have to extend it. You have to think about it and power count it and, you know, set it up in a way. I'm not sure how easy that is. It sounds doable. So, okay, so I told you before we want to push the spin effects in our waveforms to higher order because that's important for LISA and also for LIGO can be important for comparison to numerical data. So we want to introduce spin in this effective field theory framework, and that was done during Rafael Porto's PhD thesis. So I refer to those papers here. Basically, what you do is you introduce additional degrees of freedom that are located on the world line. And it's somewhat complicated and technical because, you know, if you want to make that all covariant, rotations are only 3 out of the 6 Lorentz transformations. So you need to somehow impose constraints so that we project out the boost and only are left with rotations that you're endowing your world line with. So it's a bit complicated, and I decided not to go into details here. What it does effectively from, you know, for our practical purposes, it just introduces new world line coupling vertices. So new terms in your action that results to, when you calculate Feynman diagrams, in new vertices where they couple to your world lines. And one interesting thing to point out is that for spinning objects, your power counting of finite size effects changes. So you can write down things that are linear in the Riemann tensor that contribute already at the second post-Newtonian order. And those effects are quadratic in spin, and the picture of that is the same why the Earth is not a perfect sphere. You know, the Earth is rotating, so it gets a little bit, you say squashed in English? You know, it's not completely spherical. It has an induced quadrupole, self-induced quadrupole moment to it. And that's exactly this effect that you find here in an operator analysis as well. You just write down what are the operators you can write down now that you have this anti-symmetric tensor describing spin. Okay, so now I've shown you some equations. Could I just go ahead, plug in my expansion around Minkowski spacetime for the metric and derive Feynman rules and start calculating? Yes, I could, but this is not really what we mean by doing effective field theories. We haven't completed this. So I've shown you the scales, but I haven't completely disentangled the scales yet. And in order to achieve that, to really separate the scales, we need to have a definite power counting in our small expansion parameter being the typical 3 velocity squared. And in order to do that, you have to do something that's been done previously in effective field theories describing bound states in QD and in QCD, so-called NR, non-relativistic QD and non-relativistic QCD, NR QD, NR QCD. And what you do is you divide the modes that describe your field, in our case, the gravitational field, into different kinematical regions. and they are responsible for different physical effects. And here we call them the so-called potential gravitons, the radiation gravitons, where I should say, you know, when I'm talking about gravitons, this is just a remnant from having a particle physics background. It's really modes of the gravitational field. It's not, I'm not calculating quantum effects, I'm calculating only classical effects. But we're stuck with this quantum language, I'm sorry. Now, one technical note here is that the radiation modes need to be multiple expanded. And once I do that, after having introduced those two modes and multiple expanding or Taylor expanding around the point, my radiation modes, I end up with this, what we now call the effective field theory for these systems. And inspired by NRQD and NRQCD, Walter and Ira came up with the name NRGR for non-relativistic general relativity. And you can note the irony in the name and non-relativistic relativity that kind of cancels. It's really just G. Okay, so what are those potential modes and radiation modes I was talking about? The potential modes are the guys that really give you the binding dynamics of the binary system. They are four momenta, typical four momenta scale as 1 over the wavelength, or V over R and 1 over R. So you see they're parametrically different. So the square of the momentum can never be 0. Those modes can never be on shell. So what we do is we integrate them out. That's the first step. When we're setting up this tower of effective field theories. And the radiation modes, those are the guys that really describe the physical gravitation waves, the on-shell modes that propagate all the way to hopefully LIGO and company soon and be detected. And their typical four momenta scale as 1 over the wavelength and 1 over the wavelength, so V over R, V over R. So yeah, this can be on-shell. And on a technical note is when we integrate out of potential modes, we treat the radiation modes as a background field, meaning we don't break diffeomorphism invariance with respect to our radiation modes when you integrate out the potential modes. And
so you don't keep anything that's off shell?
No.
Okay.
So.
Because sometimes in our PCD and such, you can play games, right?
Which modes do they? Well, then you can have potential NRQCD, right?
Yeah,
or
you treat them as potential. I'm just wondering how you're thinking about them. So you always treat them as a potential.
Well, this is the first scale we remove, the orbital scale, so we integrate them out.
Okay.
They are, just by definition, always off-shell. So, yeah. Okay, so then once you have introduced those modes, done a multiple expansion, you completely power count any single ingredient of your theory. Every field where it shows up in Lagrangian has a definite power counting. I won't go into the details, but Walter and Ira's original paper has it in there. And now, what does it really mean when I'm saying integrating out potential modes? What it formally means is you're taking the path integral of your action, which is in terms of the sum of both of these excitations of the gravitational field, and evaluating the path integral over e to the I, the action, over the potential modes, and then that gives you an effective action, which is only a function of the binary parameters, such as their positions and the radiation field. Of course, we can't just calculate this path integral. What we do is we calculate Feynman diagrams. So what we really do is we take this effective action, we expand it in powers of your external field, or the radiation mode h bar. So there's a piece that's h bar to the 0, we call it S0. There's a piece h bar to the first power, and they're high order pieces which turn out to be only needed at very high order for classical observables. So I'm pretty much fine now looking only at these two guys. Now, what is the physical meaning of, well, first of all, how do I now calculate them from Feynman diagrams? So what I do is integrating out these H's, meaning having them as internal degrees of freedom in my diagram. Those two lines on the side denote my two world lines. So let's say particle one, or sorry, black hole one and black hole two. Of my binary system, and this big blob can mean any amount of potential modes being exchanged between the two. Same is true for the blob here, and now my radiation mode, so since this part of the action is linear in my radiation field, it has to couple somewhere in my Feynman diagram. That's how I calculate these effective actions. Now the physical meaning of the one where I'm basically just throwing away gravitational radiation, you know, this is expanded to zeroth order in the radiation field, that gives me the conservative dynamics. Okay, so this action is just the integral over the Lagrangian, where my first order term is 1/2 mv squared for both particles, and then the Newtonian potential. That's the leading term, and then there will be high order corrections to that. So as I said, we calculate all diagrams without any external radiation gravitons, and internally you can only use the potential modes. That means you're integrating them out. You get the conservative Lagrangian, you can get the equations of motion from that simply, you can get the conserved quantities such as the energy, which is one of the things I'm after when I want to calculate my gravitational wave phase. So this has been done to the first non-trivial order, so the 1PN order by Walter and Ara in the original paper, and I've worked on the second post-Newtonian order and the third post-Newtonian order, which is state-of-the-art from more traditional methods that hasn't been done yet with the effective field theory. Okay. Now, my radiation action here that I can get, so well, the part of the effective action linearized in my radiation mode, which I can get from Feynman diagrams with one radiation mode coupling to it, I can just parameterize it. So this is I can just say, okay, the form of this effective action, piece of the effective action S1 has to be, well, it has to be integral d4x, and there has to be something times h bar. It's something I call t mu nu. It's not your standard energy momentum tensor you put on the right-hand side of the Einstein's equations, but it's really the energy momentum pseudo-tensor that also includes the effects of due to the potential modes being exchanged between the two binary systems. But it has to be not covariantly, but just partially conserved because of the gravitational Ward identity. And so basically, this is a definition of T mu nu in terms of diagrams. Calculate all these diagrams, you get your energy momentum pseudo-tensor. Okay, describing this action as one over here. And now, as I mentioned before, to get a uniform power counting, it's required that you Taylor expand this field, this external radiation field H bar, in the action around a single point. And this requirement automatically leads you to, so if you just take this general form of the action, you do the Taylor expansion of H mu nu around a single point, usually you take it to be the center of mass, which you just set to zero by choice of coordinates. Then you end up with an action that's in the form of a multiple expansion. I guess it's not a big surprise, right? I'm doing a long wavelength approximation. I have a source there. So yes, what I would like to note is because we're using the background field, when we're integrating out this, meaning when we're calculating these diagrams, it will still respect diffeomorphism invariance with respect to this radiation field. So the form of my effective action is already fixed by gauge and reparameterization invariance, and it's just a multiple expansion. All right, so that's the setup part. I have to speed up now a little bit. So now I want to talk about this radiation sector. I want to look at the problem a bit more from a general point of view. So I told you this form of this radiation action has to be of a multiple expansion form, and this is actually not limited to those binary systems. This is generic if you want to do a long wavelength approximation for an arbitrary gravitational waveform, wave source. Okay, so if you want to describe any gravitational wave source in a long wavelength limit, this is your action that you'd get. Okay, so let me point out the first two terms, the coupling to the mass and the coupling to the total angular momentum. Those are couplings to conserved quantities. They won't radiate. Radiative pieces are coming from here. This would be the quadrupole, octopole, 16-pole, whatever, all the higher-order guys of electric-type parity, and then these would be the current, quadrupole, current, octopole, etc. So one of them is coupling to the electric components of Riemann, and the other one to the magnetic ones and derivatives of these guys. So this is this theory I described earlier, where I described my gravitational wave source by just a single word line, and it's endowed with these multiple moments that really encode the internal dynamics. So my multiple moments here, those are the coefficients. When I just write this down for an arbitrary source, I don't know what those multiple moments are. So one of the tasks is to do a matching calculation, find out what are my multiple moments, what are the Wilson coefficients of this effective action. Okay, one thing to point out is the multiple expansion is just an expansion in the triplicate size of your gravitational wave source. I call it A, and for our binary system, it's really the R, the orbital scale, over the wavelength. But that's by assumption much smaller than one. But there's a second expansion parameter which would not be there. So this is completely analogous to what you learn in Jackson. This is new. This is because gravity is nonlinear. You get nonlinearities in your theory. In this effective theory, there's another expansion, so-called post-Minkowskian expansion. And it's basically an expansion in the gravitational radius of your system, or g times the mass of the total mass of the gravitational wave source divided by the wavelength. Okay. So in the PN regime, they scale as A over lambda like V and eta as V cubed. And already said that those multiple moments encode all the short distance physics of my system, and I could calculate these Wilson coefficients by matching calculation, and I'll get back to that.
Wait, what? Wait, you said that, did I understand correctly that you're saying it's the nonlinearity the system induces this second expansion, or is this is an expansion that's in the theory to begin with?
It's the theory is nonlinear, so it's there from the beginning with, but if you only calculate linear diagrams without self-interactions, you don't see this expansion here at all. I'll show it to you with diagrams. I'm sure you'll understand it from them in a minute. Okay, so now how do I calculate observables? In this radiative sector of my theory, so in the conservative sector, we calculate the energy as a function of the frequency, which is an ingredient for the phase, or you know, the conservative equations of motions, etc. But the energy was the observable. So here I'm after the power emitted in gravitational waves or the energy flux in gravitational waves. And how do I calculate that? So what I do is I calculate any observable where my double line now encodes the point particle, which describes the whole binary system, or the gravitational wave source more generally. And I calculate amplitudes where one graviton is emitted. Okay, this blob can be some self-interactions, etc. Now, from this diagram, for, you know, if you study particle physics, you can just calculate the decay rate or the graviton emission rate from that by squaring the amplitude. You have some phase space factors. Now, so that's a graviton emission rate, right? So now we're after the power emitted in gravitational waves. So we have to multiply upstairs by the energy. But, you know, if you're after the power emitted, so you just multiply it by k upstairs, which is the energy of the gravitational wave k. And then you just get the power emitted once you integrate over it. If you want to have more generally also the four momentum flux, you can also calculate, you know, the linear momentum flux. You can also calculate it by putting a ki in there. But we are primarily interested in the energy flux or the power emitted. So, okay, the total power I wrote it with the little h's here. That's the helicity plus 2 or minus 2 of the gravitons. You have to sum over these, of course. Yes, okay. All right, so at linear order in my theory, this is all very simple. I can calculate diagrams where I couple to my quadrupole moment, I emit a gravitational wave from it. This times this is the amplitude for this. I can take the current quadrupole, the octupole, etc., etc. I get, you know, very simple expressions from the amplitude that I can essentially read off from my action. I don't need to really calculate anything. And then I square the amplitude, I do this integration over phase space, and I wrote it in momentum space, but the standard formulas for the quadrupole radiation, current quadrupole, octupole, etc. And this is, you know, really just the third time derivative of your quadrupole squared averaged over time. It's just written in momentum space here. Okay, so, but this is not the whole story. My long distance effective field theory is nonlinear, so it doesn't only contain these single graviton emission diagrams where there's no interactions, but you have nonlinearities. So that introduces that the multiples start talking to each other, so they interact with each other. And what we look at, you know, first is the interaction of a gravitation wave. Well, let me show you in a diagram. Gravitation wave is emitted off the quadrupole, but then interacts with the total monopole of the source. So the physical interpretation is that, you know, this gravitational wave is not propagating in flat spacetime once it's emitted, but it's really propagating in the Schwarzschild background due to the source itself, And this so this would be an infinite number of diagrams to include the whole Schwarzschild propagator, so that's why one cannot calculate that exactly. But this leading diagram that I drew here, that basically gives you the 1 over r potential part of the Schwarzschild metric, its effect on the gravitational wave propagation. So what's interesting is that when you write down this amplitude, you see integrals that are of a certain form, but what I wanted to point out is that there are divergent integrals. They're logarithmically IR divergent integrals. And so the amplitude is divergent. If I calculate it in the dimensions, I get some expression expanded around four dimensions. You see here's the 1 over, or 2 over d minus 4 that is diverging when you go to d is equal to 4. And it's probably no big surprise. This is similar to solving a Coulomb problem in QED or in quantum mechanics, even where you also find infrared divergences, because, well, the Coulomb problem is very long range. You get IR divergences. So how does this get cured once you calculate observables? Well, the observable was proportional to the amplitude squared. And the little thing is that this diagram's amplitude is proportional. It's the leading order amplitude times, then there's a little factor of I, so it's imaginary. But once you square the amplitude, you're just interested in the real part. Or in other words, from all the stuff in my parentheses here, I only need the imaginary part. And that only comes from this. You know, this is really log of minus 1. That you have a definite I epsilon prescription that gives you the right factor of pi there. So all you get from all this stuff is just a pi. Your divergence just drops out. Once you square the amplitude, the divergence drops out. So your observables are not IR divergent, just the amplitude is. And so this leading term has an extra pi in there, and that's the so-called leading tail effect. And it turns out that this is actually independent of the radiative multiple moment and can be understood as just being propagation in the 1 over r potential rather than being propagation in Minkowski spacetime. The propagation doesn't depend on which multiple moment was the one radiating this wave. Okay, so now we want to go to even higher order because there are interesting effects that can show up. And we did that calculation. So there, we want to calculate gravitational waves emitted by the quadrupole interacting twice with the total energy of the gravitational wave source. So we have those three diagrams to calculate. And it turns out they're really hard ones because they involve integrals that are of the form of two-loop integrals. And it took us some time to learn the techniques to calculate these, et cetera, et cetera. And what makes them so complicated, and in particular this last diagram here, is very complicated, because it involves both ultraviolet and infrared divergences. And so what do you do? So OK, we did this calculation. I'm not telling you details of how to calculate it. But here's the result we get. Once we square the amplitude, we see again that all the infrared divergences drop out. And it's actually been shown in the 60s by Weinberg that something like this has to happen, because these kind of infrared divergences are just, if you did them to all orders, they're just a phase of the amplitude. So the amplitude goes like something times e to the I of 1 over epsilon IR. So once you square the amplitude, this phase just isn't there. So the infrared divergences go away automatically, we find, which is nice, and which is what should be, of course. However, the UV divergences are real divergences in my effective field theory calculation. And even when you square the amplitudes, they're here. So this is my order eta, leading order in nonlinearities. And this is order eta squared, second order nonlinearities. You see that's the 1 over epsilon UV. There's a log, an arbitrary scale introduced to in-dimensional regularization. We know that these guys have to cancel. Right? These guys can't be there in physical observables. This is already the amplitude squared. But what's a little bit not so good in the way I wrote this equation for this presentation is that it's really normalized by the leading order amplitude. This leading order amplitude squared, that includes the coupling constant being the quadrupole moment here. Okay. So what we have to do is we have to renormalize the quadrupole. So meaning the physics can't be depending on mu, for example. So we know the way it has to be canceled by renormalizing the quadrupole. So we find the mu dependence of the quadrupole given by an RG equation. And we can easily solve it and then, you know, relate the quadrupole at some scale to the quadrupole evaluated at some other scale. So we find classical RG flow for our gravitational wave source's quadrupole moment. So what you typically do in effective field theories is that you choose your arbitrary scale to be of the order of the scale that you're calculating in the effective field theory with, so that here you don't get a big logarithm. So you use it, just set mu is equal to k. So that's just log of 1 or 0. And then this mu 0 here, that is usually chosen to be related to your scale where you're of the size of the gravitational wave source. And let me try to explain this again, looking at this type of diagram for binary systems. So I'm really calculating at the wavelength scale here in the effective field theory, right? So I'm using this effective field theory to calculate gravitational wave observables. So that's at the scale of the wavelength. But when I'm doing a matching calculation to get my quadrupole in the first place, I would do that matching calculation at the size of the gravitational wave source for the binary system that is the orbital separation. So what this RG flow equation that we find is really describing the running from R to lambda, so from the extent of the gravitational wave source run down to the wavelength scale. Okay, so in general, effective field theories are a great tool to resum logs. And in QCD, there are many examples, for example, where it's essential to resum logarithms because they can become large. So if this is the coupling constant of QCD, then this is, let's say, 0.1. And sometimes you get logs that are of order 10. So you get, a correction in your perturbation series that's of order 1. And that's, of course, spoiling your perturbation series. So it's essential to resum them, use the RG. Unfortunately, in gravitational wave physics, those terms cannot become large. And the reason for that is that the coupling constant here is my nonlinearities expansion parameter, and that's eta. And then my log is in the ratio of the finite size scale over the wavelength. Now, remember, eta is actually the Schwarzschild radius over lambda. So lambda is the biggest scale. So this is a small number, and a over lambda is also a small number. So in order for this log to compensate this guy, a would have to be way, way, way smaller than the Schwarzschild radius. But obviously, no gravitational wave source has an extent less than its Schwarzschild radius. So that's why these logarithms cannot become. Well, we would have become famous, maybe, if it was totally essential to resum them. But so it's nice from the theoretical point of view, and I like it, but it's not essential to resum those logs for phenomenology. But we do predict what would be the coefficient of a log, which is at order eta to the fourth, and then it has a log squared, and then there will be a log cube term, etc. So these come just from solving the RG equations. And what I want to say is that, this whole calculation of the running of the quadrupole moments, that only assumed the multiple expansion. So that's actually completely independent if you're looking at a binary black hole or at a binary system, or if you're maybe looking at, a long wavelength contribution from Hawking radiation in gravitational waves or something like this. So it's independent of the short distance physics of your source itself. And in the post-Newtonian case, it predicts the log powers at certain post-Newtonian order. And so this log squared, we predict the coefficient of it, which would be a 6 post-Newtonian order. So unfortunately, unmeasurably small.
So what was mu now? Mu naught. Mu zero.
Mu zero?
Yeah. What is it?
Oh, that would be of the order of the orbital separation for the post-Newtonian case, or the size of your gravitational wave source in general. And that you have to actually determine from a matching calculation, which is what we haven't done yet. Okay, so just very briefly, this is just leading log resummation. There will be higher order logs at every even orders. At order eta to the fourth, there will be another log that this does not resum. Then you would need to calculate the next two leading log resummation, which would be a very hard calculation in these systems. It's dependent on the multiple moment, so we've only calculated the quadrupole. If you wanted to know how does the octupole run, you have to do this calculation again. We've had some ideas how to calculate this for arbitrary moments, but since it's not important, we didn't do that. But possibly, some people are interested in calculating resummed waveforms. You may have heard of this effective one-body approach by Damour and Buonanno and others, where they're doing some kind of resummation, and this would be a systematic resummation. Systematic in the sense that it really predicts terms in your post-Newtonian order. Non-systematic in the sense that, those terms you're resumming are not bigger than the ones you're actually leaving out. At least naively, they aren't. Unless they're, coefficients in front, and numerical coefficients could be bigger, but yeah. We can also resum the infrared effects, and that has already been done. We've been scooped by people for a couple of years. But it's interesting anyways, and we see that the infrared and UV resummations factorize. Let me not skip that, the details.
Just to make sure that guy was Russian.
Kriplovich?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. He still is.
You're right on time. 10 years later, that's when we do it.
Well, there's also a Japanese group that did it.
Very good. All right.
And it's actually already incorporated by, in this effective one-body approach. It's been done by Damur and Nagar a while ago, too. Okay, so now I told you...
Effective one-body approach is you like replace a two-body problem by one-body problem?
That's it's complicated. I don't know the whole details of it. So somehow they model... They model the gravitation waves from this two-body problem with something that's one-body, but I don't understand the details.
But then you're saying what is included
not,
in
it's a model, really. It's not, but it somehow is able to incorporate systematically the known post-Newtonian effects, and it's also supposed to interpolate between in-spiral and merger phase, fitting certain parameters to numerical results. So it's an attempt at doing the whole waveform analytically. But, you know, your theory breaks down at the merger, so there are some elements of it that are non-systematic. But there's some resummation in it that is systematic. So it's useful, too, because we can't quickly calculate every single point in parameter space numerically the waveforms. But I don't know much about it. It's not my cup of tea. Anyway, so now I showed you this multipole expansion action with just arbitrary multipole coefficients. How do I do the matching? And for that, we have to go back to our, you know, full theory, and now double quotation marks, and actually calculate diagrams where I have still my potential modes in the system. So we calculate these amplitudes with one gravitational wave leg externally, one radiation leg externally, and any number of potential modes being exchanged. And that defines this T-menu that I talked about earlier. And in order, so basically this action, all these diagrams added together give you this action. Now if you just Taylor expand your radiation field here around a single point, you can just take exactly this action, which is just one line, and put it exactly into this form of the multiple expansion. In other words, you can express your multiple moments, quadrupole, current quadrupole, etc., in terms of integrals over T-menu and axis, so the so-called moments of T-menu. So for example, your leading quadrupole is integral d3x t0, 0, xi, xj. The post-Newtonian limit, at least, that's the leading guy, and then there will be higher order terms as well. So it's straightforward to do that. One needs to do some group theory because you have to decompose those multiple moments in symmetric trace-free tensors, but it's, as I said, straightforward. And skip some details here. Yeah, then you get your T-menus from calculating diagrams where you take your... Yes, okay. Do I have...
No, I just wanted...
2 minutes? Okay, thanks. So you have to calculate diagrams like this at leading order. So this is just no potential mode being exchanged, just one radiation coupling to just the mass. So this gives you the leading quadrupole. Well, leading energy density in coordinate space would be just m times the delta function. But then there will be corrections to the energy. The mass is just the leading term. And there will be v squared corrections from having the sources each moving. And then there's, you know, the gravitational field in between the sources. It and these type of diagrams account for them. If we calculate them for systems without spin, we get the right answer for all the terms we've attempted to calculate, and we can combine it with those nonlinearity calculations in the effective field theory to get all the terms right that we attempted and could compare with the known results. Okay, then I have to be very brief, but I want to describe also our work in spin, at least schematically. So there's the conservative dynamics that will lead to the energy as a function of the frequency. That has been completed by Raphael Porto and Aaron Rothstein in these papers over here. And now we've just computed the matching for all those multiple moments that are needed to calculate the energy flux at 3pn, and then it will lead to the phase at 3pn. So now that completes the calculation of the 3pn phase in terms of field theory calculations. What is left is to, you know, rearrange things and put them into a form that's actually usable and useful for experimentalists, etc. So that's now work in progress, bringing them into the form of observables, our results. Okay, so that basically, in order to know which type of effects will show up, you have to do some power counting. I don't have time to go into the details, but just want to say you get contributions linear and quadratic in spin. And yeah, you can power count exactly at what order they come into your multiple moments. In the multiple moments, in turn, you square them, essentially take some derivatives of it in coordinate space, and they give you the power emitted in gravitational waves, our observable needed for the phase. and we need to get to certain orders. It's up at most next to leading order in terms of the moments. So that means we never have to exchange more than just one potential mode between those diagrams. And those diagrams are very simple in the sense that the hardest integral you ever have to do is the Fourier transform of 1 over k squared to some power. And you know, the same integral with tensor structure upstairs. But that's super simple in terms of integrals. It's a bookkeeping nightmare to some extent. And this is the result you find. So you see it's a long answer. Once you have, you know, spins and velocities, you can construct thousands of different structures to contract them. So this is my quadrupole that is needed for my phase to first post-Newton order. And that probably shows you why nobody wanted to calculate this before. And then this is the current quadrupole, current octopole, and octopole. So I won't tell you any of the details for our results. Let me give you an outlook what we're still working on, what will come in the future. So for a spinless system, this effective field theory framework is still catching up with traditional methods. Somehow it's a bit demotivating, you know, just reproducing the results. So probably that's why there's not faster progress in calculations for the spinless systems. One interesting question, however, is can we go beyond the third post-Newtonian order? Could we do 4PN with our framework? I'm sure one can do it. It's hard. I have some ideas about it, but I probably should be tenured for starting this problem. I'm not nowhere close to that. I'm a poster. So we're, at the moment, we're calculating the full spin dependence in the phase of the gravitational wave signal to 3PN. We're also computing very few additional moments we'd need to get the full spin dependence in the amplitude to 2.5 pn. It's actually an incredibly simple extension of the results I've just shown you. And eventually, we want to reach the 3.5 pn precision, which is known for spinless, for binaries when you eject spin, also including all those spin effects. Let me conclude. Sorry to keep you a bit longer. So this effective field theory framework is a systematic, and in my opinion, at least transparent way to organize these classical calculations of gravitational wave observables. It's not limited to this post-Newtonian expansion that I've introduced and used here, but you can also expand in the mass ratio, as you've probably seen in a talk by Chad Galley a couple of weeks ago. Also, this method is not limited to gravitational applications. You can use those world and effective field theories to describe other types of systems. Ira recently calculated some biophysics application of this framework. And we're catching up with the more traditional ways to calculate these derivative calculations. But I want to say that we have already a new resummation from the RG that we found, even though it's not required from a phenomenological point of view. It's interesting theoretically, I think. And we're getting new results now for spin that are important for LIGO, NISA, et cetera. Thank you.
Questions? So eventually you want to do better than the traditional methods. So somehow, apparently all the calculations that have been done has already been done in traditional methods.
Well, not the spin calculations.
Not the spin calculations?
So we're doing that for the first time, yes.
You're doing that again?
Yes.
And is somebody else doing that from traditional
methods? Not that I know of, no.
But your work isn't finished yet,
right? Well, we've done the whole, it depends on which part of the work. But the whole project will be, it's a multi-year project to really match the same precision. That's not finished yet, no. That still involves a couple of hard calculations.
So, can you test this against simulations, or I mean, is that actually useful?
Words mean.
So the simulations only can go for 40 orbits or something like this, right? So to really see this high precision corrections, you have to look at like 10,000 orbits, or you know, a bigger number of orbits.
I see. So is the simulation better?
And in the non-perturbative regime, I don't trust my theory, right? People like to compare in the non-perturbative regime. How far in the non-perturbative regime does this hold?
Well, I mean, anytime you do a calculation, you'd like to be able to test it, right? Well, you didn't miss
it against an actual observable.
So,
I think we have to finish because guys
don't Well,
we keep them there.
Well, one way to test it is there are known results for the test particle limit, where you take one of the masses much, much larger than the other, and expand this result in the post-Newtonian expansion. Those results are known to 5.5 pn without spin. And some spin effects are known to 3 pn. So we will compare to these.
Okay.
the test particle limit. So there are some checks you can do.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thanks.
That sounds good.